Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Poetry. I am your host, Jen Fitzgerald. It's great to be back after a brief hiatus, especially when we get to burst through the door with a poet like Karina Borovitch. She's the author of Proof, Kato Press, 2014, winner of the Kato Press Poetry Prize. Her debut collection, The Bees Are Waiting, Marek Press, 2012, was selected by Franz Wright for the Marek Press Poetry Prize and named a must-read by the Massachusetts Center for the Book. Her poems have appeared widely in journals and have been featured in Poetry Daily, Verse Daily, Ted Kooser's American Life and Poetry Series, and on Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac. She has published translations from the Russian and the French. Trained as a historian, Borovitch also holds an MFA from the University of New Hampshire. She makes her home in the Connecticut River Valley of Western Massachusetts. Welcome, Karina.
Thank you very much.
So I'd like to get to know a little bit about you before we start talking about the new collection, if that's okay.
All right. Well, I don't know, just to start at the beginning, I guess I'll talk about the fact that I grew up in Massachusetts on the coast in New Bedford, Mass., which is a very interesting place. It was the of course, the whaling capital of the world back in the 19th century, and very cosmopolitan place. So I think it influenced my writing quite a bit. And as you could probably tell from my books, I'm very much interested in place and bringing a sense of place into my work. And it started at a young age, just exploring the place that I was born and grew up, and continues to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did get that sense from this collection, especially. So do you have any siblings?
Yep, I've got an older sister. I'm the middle child, and I have a younger brother who's a painter, a visual artist. And my mom is a sculptor. She got her BFA in sculpture. So we kind of do the arts in my family to a certain extent. There's some singers and musicians. My mother's father was a physician, so we try to cover all the bases.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. I had always dreamed of growing up in an artistic household. That would have been nice. So let's hear some of your work, if you don't mind, for our first poem. Would you read Midnight Train on page 14?
Sure. Get to that one. Okay. Midnight Train. I don't recall ever asking for any of this, being born, having to live an upstanding American life, all of a sudden getting old, coming to fear the very oblivion they would have preferred in the first place. As a child, I was carried by a beast of sadness. At the least likely moments, I'd feel it bristle my skin, for instance, eating pizza at the mall, and the feeling would take my breath away. My greasy fingers had become suddenly so small and strange. Gladys Knight and the Pips lit the jukebox with Midnight Train, and I was dying of this painful humanness, yet dreading the white noise of heaven.
Thank you very much. I really liked that poem. It resonated with me. So the first 10 or so poems in the collection seem to focus their lens in on the hands, whether it be sewing, woodworking, painting, brushing a horse. They are also very grounded in the real until this poem, Midnight Train. Then we move into sensory as the speaker places him or herself in a new popular culture. Now, how did you decide on placement in the collection?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question and one that I love talking about because the placement, the ordering of the poems is not the original ordering. This was this particular collection went through a lot of different orders, and it's a real interesting process. So my original ordering had more space between poems that shared similar themes or, were childhood poems or nostalgia poems. I wanted to widen the spaces between those. The editor at Cod Hill, Pauline Ukmanovich, though, he ordered it in a way that I saw all of a sudden it's opened the collection up. It's something that I hadn't seen before, being so close to the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved her reordering, and that was how the present order came about. It was Pauline's ordering, and we worked with that, and we tried to spark poems off of each other and work with a much closer energy, poems together, speaking about themes, and picking up on one thing and then another in closer proximity. And I really, really like how it came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the sense that I got from this too, that it felt very tight, almost like something slowly emerging or being whittled away at.
Mm-hmm.
It's very cool.
Yeah, and I like the way you say that, and I think in my original ordering it was much more about echoing, and that was somehow not as satisfactory as the present one.
Hmm. So let's hear another poem. Would you read Sunbeam Bread on page 20?
And this is it's interesting, the poems that you've chosen. This is another childhood nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
There is that theme running through this book, for sure. Sunbeam Bread. How I hated those white gloves, which smelled of lavender sachet, whose seams bit my fingers. After Mass, I'd hold out my hands, palms up, and beg my mother to pull them off. Sundays, too, we'd drive down to the bay and feed the ducks that week's leftover bread. It was one of my father's favorite things, to walk softly to the water's edge and toss handfuls onto the surface. Like toy sailboats, the ducks would glide leisurely over to claim the floating crusts. Once I ventured out onto the boulders. I looked down and could see the ducks' yellow feet paddling frantically beneath the surface.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So this poem, I hesitated. I put it in, I took it out, I put it in. I said, I want to talk about this. I felt as though it was a departure from everything that I was, putting together for this interview. Mm-hmm. But when you said that it was like the first one that I asked you to, that it was that younger, what had you said?
It's childhood nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a vulnerability and a sentimentality to it that I connected to. But then the last stanza to me seemed almost menacing. Am I right in that?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Yep.
So how did this poem come to be?
Well, you know, it's one of those poems that sort of just comes into the world without a lot of forethought, without a lot of planning. You start writing, you fasten on a memory, and you want to see where it takes you. And that's where it took me, strangely enough. It did. It has this menacing undertone and this feeling of being a child and feeling something always simmering under the surface and being able to see a little bit of what's going on under the surface. So it was, I don't know, call it the subconscious or what you will, but it sort of just wrote itself.
Yeah, no, wonderfully executed, for sure.
Thank you.
So the collection is in three parts, and within each part there seems to be a natural progression of awareness. Did the poems form somewhat organically into these parts, or did you or the editor impose that form on them after the fact?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the order has changed. It had been changed several times. But I think what was going on was, this is my writing over about 3 years or so, and I typically don't sit down with a project or have in mind to write a project book, if you will. But I think that there were themes I was revisiting, despite myself, over those several years that then will come out in the collection and will be emphasized, certainly by the ordering. I think that this was maybe a project book, despite the fact that I don't set out to write a project, but the project being childhood nostalgia in many ways. I think that's fair to say.
And even more than nostalgia, it's awareness. It is, a coming to understanding, the way that we progress from adolescence into adulthood and the types of, I guess, jarring moments that give us greater understanding.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the title, too, speaks to that. And it talks about proof of our existence. Mm-hmm. It also talks about proof in absence. Some of the poems in the collection are elegy poems, mm-hmm. family members who are lost, friends who are departed. So this notion of proof and figuring out how we leave our mark and how others leave a mark on us and in our lives and in the places that we live is definitely, I think, the overarching theme of the book.
Yeah. Would you like to read that title poem for us on page 45?
Sure. Proof. The day they moved your belongings outside, it snowed. The flakes came to rest on your stained pillow. Huge clustered snowflakes clung to a pile of paper bags. The lamp, its pleated shade askew, wasn't made for that kind of weather. A life taken down, brick by brick. The past being carted away. Proof will never be back. Boxes and boxes. Your feet so tiny, the shoes looked like children's. They emptied dresser drawers into cartons and lined them up, open to the sky, a pair of spare eyeglasses upside down and cooling with melted snow. An address book sprawled open, names of the dead in your gold hand. A gold lipstick case, tangle of lace curtains, antiqued by cigarettes. The neighbors thought, so that's how she lived.
Thank you. This one haunted me a little bit. Was this one of those instances where you were revisiting moments despite yourself?
Yes, in a way. This one was written as an elegy for an aunt of mine who I became close with later in her life, and I just felt, and I sort of watched her becoming older, becoming more dependent, and that sort of the final years, the final days when a person is going away, is departing this life, and that haunted me, like you said. Use those words, so I definitely wanted to write something about that. That's the poem that came from. And it's focused very much on her things. Like some of the other poems in the book, I focused on how a person's presence and how a person's life, maybe we can get the sense of it, or maybe not, from the things that they leave behind. So for me, this poem is akin to some of the other poems in the book that are based on experiences and visits to authors' home museums, like the Emily Dickinson Home Museum, in Amherst and the Marina Tsvetaeva Museum in Moscow, Russia. This notion of looking at people's things and trying to conjure up their presence, even when they're gone.
Mm-hmm. I had also noticed that many of these poems, they do take inventory in a way, kind of like this one does. Especially, I think it was the third section, felt very much to me like a museum. Wrong there?
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And as I mentioned, this notion of going to museums, there are a few other poems in the book about museums. They're not authors from museums, but there are some authors from museums in it as well. This notion of just looking at these things and trying to figure out the life that's behind these objects. And the very strange notion, too, that objects often outlive people. You know, they have a longer life. And we don't really think of that. We think of them as just things, just throw away. But they can exist for hundreds of years, whereas people don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this actually helps me segue perfectly into what I wanted to discuss about your training as a historian. Could you read Folk on page 49?
Sure. Folk. If you asked me to choose, I'd say the Azorians. Not the thin-lipped progeny of the Quaker captains of industry. That's the rock and the hard place I grew up against, the São Miguel fisher folk with their black rosaries and fado, the Yankee owners of the golder spoon pastures by the sea, salt marshes and haunted paddocks. Old man Slade would roam the fields with a darning needle in his pocket, jabbing wren's eggs to save, he said, the bluebirds. Wild lilies grew alongside tumble-down stone walls for miles to the beach. But in town, almost every backyard was a shrine to Fatima, three stone children and a lamb kneeling before Mary, zinnias planted piously around, geraniums. Red was the color the Azorians were used to life on the volcano, the lush growth that comes from ash. What they didn't get was the Yankee penchant for solitude and disdain for music, which seemed more like a disdain for the depths and joy, for the depths of joy and sorrow. Living up against the sea like we did, how could you not want to describe it?
Thank you. So how has your study of history informed your poetry?
Wow. Well, you know, ever since I was a child, I was fascinated with history. My father is a retired history teacher and always had a love of history. We had many, many history books around the house, and I have to say those were some of the earliest books that I read and some of my favorite books when I was a child. So I think and also living in the place that I lived in, this very historical city, and this is where Melville started writing, Moby Dick starts in New Bedford. I think that I was just imbued with a sense of history. Also, New Bedford is an immigrant city, and we were surrounded by people who were pining for the old country and always talking about the old country, and that includes my family as well. My family was very much eastward oriented toward the old country. So I think this really just helped form my character and instilled in me a great sense of history and a great love of history. So it's nothing that I overtly try to bring into my poems these days. It's just something I think that's part of my character. So I think it comes out in my poems. It's one of my interests, and I think your interests tend to come out in your writing.
Mm-hmm. And it works perfectly for poetry because I think poetry likes best when it can take a small event and give it context, whether it be historical or emotional or intellectual. So,
definitely. And this notion of time, too, is something that I've always been fascinated by. Sort of, we're living simultaneously in the past and in the future and in the present. But it all just is collaged together in a single moment. And that's something that I that I am trying to get at in my poetry, sort of show the multifaceted way we inhabit time.
Hmm. Would you mind expanding on that a little, if you don't mind?
Let's see. Well, it's a little hard to talk about because for me it just seems almost spiritual in a way. But for me, for instance, I'll be, you know, walking down the street on a spring morning. And I'm not only walking down the street on a spring morning right here and now, but in my memory as well, I'm remembering all the sights and sounds of spring in my childhood and in my young adulthood, and that's informing the present moment and enriching it. So I think this notion of inhabiting multiple levels of time at the same time just lends a real richness to life and to writing as well.
Mm-hmm. Those are the moments that I think create writers. I know that Virginia Woolf, when she was writing her memoir, that she was reaching towards that fully present in the moment state of being. And in order to do that, you have to also be fully present in your own narrative. It's something that I work hard on doing too. And it's comforting to know that there's another poet out there torturing herself.
Mm. But it is fascinating. And I like how you mentioned being present in your own narrative, because everyone's life is a narrative. I mean, whether it's something that we superimpose on life or whether it's a natural, organic thing, it's very human to be drawn to narratives and to need narratives. And a narrative is something that unfolds within time. So again, it's very much related to time.
Hmm. I think we could probably talk about this for an hour just on
absolutely.
So for the final reading, I was hoping that I might get you to read three poems in a row. To me, they are bonded, almost as a triptych. Guest Room on page 59, then Sanctuary and Blake.
We start with Guest Room on 59. And again, this is one of those childhood poems. Guest Room. The wasps go about their business in the far corner of the room. They're drawn, it seems, through no power of their own, into a tiny crevice where the ceiling and walls meet, dark bodies sucked into beyond that I can't cross. Then one by one, they're pushed out of that space, refreshed and eager to continue work for the world. Their segmented figures make my neck prickle with fear and need to hide. But I'm told, never mind, there's nothing from me they could possibly want. Okay, and next up we have Sanctuary. They hollowed out the lintel above our door and fought me every morning. Dawn came when they had to shudder their wings wildly against the wall, especially having slept flattened into that small space. I felt clawed awake every day by something big and terrible, something intendingly hard. Though I tucked handwritten poems of Frost and Blake beneath my pillow for sustenance and a little light, it was such a dark time, fighting and flying away, coming back loudly to roost. And finally, Blake. I go to Blake for solace, for a nightlight, for a vase of tiger lilies. The moon was always beyond the trees. The trees were far away, purple shadows with hooked claws thrown upon the moon. The moon was there for a reason that I couldn't manage to guess. Question, round and white, sometimes with horns, looked down upon me. Watch animal patience in a gentle face. One night, a voice came through the window. There were always voices, this one more like a silver coin worn from someone's hand. Blake's hand. But the coin wasn't an answer, and it couldn't purchase one.
Thank you. I think that I am connecting most with these poems because, the childhood and adolescence poems. It's because I see the speaker begin to bob above the surface a little. He or she comes into focus. And I'm grabbing onto those as my anchors to pull me through the book. Could you tell me about these three pieces? Because I feel the kinship here.
Yeah, and you're right, and they occur close together in the book, one right after the other. So they are sort of a triptych. Guest room to me is a lot like one of the earlier poems I read, Sunbeam Bread. You see something occurring in the natural world. You see animals going about their daily business, and it feels removed from us in a certain way. But there's something going on behind under the surface that we feel we can't touch, we can't join, but it's a little worrisome, a little sinister, and you definitely get that in Guest Room. Now this one's based on a true experience. When I would stay in my grandmother's guest room, she lived out in the country. There was a wasp's nest in the guest room, and there were all these wasps coming in and out of this crevice, and it really freaked me out. But I was told, just don't think about it. They're not going to bother you if they don't bother them. So I made my peace with it. There was something going on in my mind, just fastened onto it. And many, many years later, it sort of came floating back to the surface, and I wrote about it. And in the Sanctuary in Blake, the same sort of thing is going on too. There is something just below the surface. That does feel a little sinister, a little worrisome. And in these two pieces, again, it's a child who doesn't quite know what it's all about, who's discovering the world, and who feels possibly the presence of evil under the surface, under the placid surface of maybe the childhood neighborhood or the childhood home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also got the feeling of a speaker trying to comfort themselves or seeking out comfort in some way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this too speaks to my love of history and my attraction to history from an early age. I read a lot of the history books that my dad had at home, and he was very interested in European history, particularly the history of World War II and the Soviet Union. So I would be looking at these books when I was really young, and this notion of evil put in the world, I came to very early, and it sort of shattered my innocence in a way.
Yeah.
So that I was grappling with these big questions of good and evil in the world. And I think that this definitely comes out in these poems. The child, of course, is observing the natural world in some of these poems, and still the wheels are turning about these larger questions that maybe don't have anything to do with the natural world, that have to do with the world of humans. But the questions are just so large that they're always there.
Yeah, well, the natural world is one of our first introductions to what we would perceive as cruelty. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I guess in some way prepares us for the more conscious cruelty that we witness from our fellow humans. Mm-hmm. If we could ever be prepared for such a thing, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, who are you reading now?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I'm always juggling a few poetry books. Right now I'm reading a new book. It's just out, by a poet named Teddy Macker. The title of the book is This World. And he's a poet after my own heart. He writes he's intensely invested in place and in the natural world, and in the personal narrative and the human life and human understanding over time, as we change over time. So I'm enjoying it very much. What else am I reading? I'm reading food memoir, too. I'm reading MFK Fisher. She's a wonderful prose writer. So her prose is really... And this is a thing that I'm very interested in, is voice. So her voice is very transparent. You know, the words don't get in the way. Because it, in many ways it bothers me when the words get between the reader and the writer.
Mm-hmm.
But here's an example of someone who the words just, they kind of dissipate on the page. And you're very close to meaning and feeling and emotion without the words getting in the way. So it's interesting to me to read Fisher and try to figure out what's going on and how she's able to accomplish that.
Mm. So how do you take something like that with trying to not let the words get in the way of the writer and the reader when you're working on translations?
Translation is all about the words at that point in the process. But ultimately you have to be striving for an end product where the words aren't in the way. So it's a balancing act, and it's a difficult thing to do. And it takes a lot of focus, a lot of attention, and a lot of patience. You may be working on a very short poem for months and months at a time, trying to get it just right, trying to get it to read like a poem that had been written in English. So it can be very labor intensive, but ultimately very, very satisfying. And I think too, doing quite a bit of translation years ago got me very interested in the craft of poetry and taught me a lot of good lessons, very valuable lessons about how poems are put together. So it's something I would recommend for all poets who have a second language or a third language, or maybe don't. Maybe you can pick up another language with a view towards translating. It's very valuable.
Yeah, I've always been a little jealous of people who are able to understand poetry in other languages, especially when those languages have words and you know, meanings or sayings that do not directly translate into English.
Mm,
yeah. So do you translate predominantly poetry?
Only poetry.
Only poetry.
Yeah,
okay.
Only poetry.
Excellent. So what would you pursue if you couldn't write poetry?
Wow, that is, you know what, that is a wonderful question, because I think there's so much out there. I almost became a cook. I worked professionally in kitchens for many, many years, putting myself through college and beyond. I love food. I love cooking. I love thinking about it. I love writing recipes. So I was squarely in the world of food for a very long time. And I was at a crossroads at one point in my life in my late 20s. And I was thinking, okay, am I going to pursue writing and language more seriously, or am I going to pursue a career as a chef? And it was a tough decision, I have to say, but ultimately, we can see how it ended up, but I still love food, and I still love food.
We are very glad that you chose poetry.
Thank you.
So what is your favorite dish to make?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I love making soup. I love making soup. I love making borscht, actually, best of all. That's one of my favorite things to eat. There you go.
So is there anything on the horizon? I know you said that this book took 3 years to write. Are you churning out another one? Are you writing?
I'm in the process of putting together another manuscript. I'm at the very beginning stages of, you know, throwing all the poems from the past couple of years, about the past 3 years maybe, on the table, figuring out, you know, what can stay and what can go. What needs more revision, what doesn't. So I'm at that point. And so hopefully maybe within the next couple of years, there will be another book out there.
Well, I definitely look forward to it. I want to thank you for spending this time with us and sharing your work. It was a real pleasure.
It was a great pleasure, Jen. Thank you very much.
This is Jen Fitzgerald with New Books in Poetry, reminding you to support all the arts, but especially poetry.